Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, along with the Week in Files. This time we're going to collage our way back through the lyric of old, and we'll visit an art installation in Killer that is also, maybe mostly, a treehouse. But we start on the ground in one of the world's great museums. Lonnie G. Bunch III is the 14th secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. This puts him in charge of 21 museums, 21 libraries, the National Zoo, numerous researchers and several educational units and centres in Washington, D.C. He started out studying history before working his way up the ranks of the Smithsonian, becoming the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Lonnie Bunch was in Dublin recently for the Humanities Horizons event at Trinity's Long Room Hub, where he spoke about his vision for the Smithsonian and his recent discovery that his DNA indicates he is 18% Irish, traced from an ancestor in Donegal. But as he told Culture File's Louise Williams after the talk, the discovery tends to leave him with some ambivalent feelings, and this piece contains content that some listeners may find disturbing.
DNA has really helped people, not to the certainty that they think, but to an idea of who you are. And so which I didn't do for years, when I finally did my DNA and it came out that I was sort of roughly 18% of Irish ancestry, my first thought was, because that's not who I look like and that's not how I've been dealt with as a Black American. But I also realized that there's a significant part of my mother's family that are very, as their phrase was, fair, very light in complexion. And I thought that I knew where that came from. I had never done my own genealogy. It wasn't something that was interesting to me. And then probably 15 years or maybe even 20 years ago, my dad's only sibling died and my father was sort of lost. And one day he came to visit me. I was living in Washington. I said, let's go to the National Archives. This is before Ancestry.com and all that. Let's go to the National Archives and let's see if we can figure out your family, because his father was 50 when he was born. So he really didn't know much. So suddenly we find his grandfather and we find all this material. And as I'm doing the other side of my family, I see the people who are very fair, the light skin. And it really, part of it comes from this slave owner named Daugherty. For years, I just had his name, Jeremiah Daugherty, and I didn't pay any attention to it. And then I thought, well, it'd be interesting to figure out more. And so when I found out the percentage that was Irish, and I did a little bit of looking back for a couple generations of his family, but to be honest, I was done with it. I was like, okay, that's it. And then when it turned out I was coming here, I mentioned it to someone, and next thing I know, they want me to go to the Daugherty land and Donegal and places like that. And it was really interesting, because on the one hand, it's fascinating to sort of try to understand the completeness of who you are. But on the other hand, I wanted people to know that this is not the joyous reunion that one would expect. This is really about power or the lack of power. I would find it hard to believe, I don't know this for a fact, but I'd find it hard to believe that these were consensual relationships, right? And so on the one hand, it's a acceptance of the totality of who you are, but to accept that, you also have to accept that this is real illustration of a power dynamic and a real illustration of the kind of abuse of women that was rampant in the slave system. So it is, so much of my life is a two-sided coin. It is this, isn't this really interesting? This is a part of me that I don't know. But on the other hand, it's a part that really is, candidly, an example of some of the worst of America. And so it really has made me, as a historian, it's really forcing me to try to think a little more about using that story as a way to illuminate the bigger issues and the long-term legacy.
Is it uncomfortable to talk about it? And is it uncomfortable being here and me asking these questions?
No, not at all. I mean, it's interesting. Being here forces me to think about it in ways that I don't, right? And because of the overwhelming number of people who say, oh, I'm a Dougherty, I'm your cousin. You know, on the one hand, that's fun and that's it. But on the other hand, it's sort of like, but do you know what that means? There's cousins by choice and cousins by force. And this is cousin by force. And so I think that it's not uncomfortable. It's just that I haven't processed it completely, right? I haven't really figured out how do I feel. It's almost like, you know, when you do, what do you call the family genealogy traits and the scheme, sort of there's all the family and then there's the Dougherty over here. And, you know, sort of trying to figure out how much of that do you put in.
How does it get integrated into the story of your ancestors and of who you are today?
Exactly. And because it has a really interesting domino effect, right? You have all of these particular branches of the family that are very fair, light-skinned, some pass for white, some, you know, married only people of the same complexion. So there's a lot more complexity that this is raising for me to think about, and it'll give me the next 20 years to grapple with it.
I'm going to ask you a question. You don't have to answer this. But when you brought this up, people laughed, and I felt it was an embarrassment, possibly. I don't know how you felt about that.
There's a nervous laughter because, one, people aren't sure how I react to it, and people aren't sure what does that really mean. Right? Does it mean that there was a love affair, a consensual relationship? Does it mean something else? So part of the nervousness is that it's a concrete example of things we know. The lack of control, the lack of power, the dominance that a white male would have over a black woman. So I think there was some of the nervousness around that. And for me, it's just I'm still trying to process and think about what that really means.
Maybe it also comes down to kind of Irish people sometimes having a tendency to frame ourselves as the underdog. Maybe that's it's a sort of a confrontation with a very traditionally held idea, false idea.
I think that one of the things I've learned here is the complexity of the Irish story independently of the Troubles, right? The notion that the Irish are colonized and sometimes colonizers, that the Irish are attacked and abused and conquered, but they also attacked, abused, and conquered. So I think that what it really demonstrates is something that's really important that most people aren't comfortable with, which is how do you help people embrace the ambiguity of the past, of these issues? You know, as I say to people, we always think about what are simple answers to complex questions. But history is ripe with ambiguity. My story is ripe with ambiguity. How do you grapple with that? And I think that's where the learning is. I think that's where the pain is. But I think that's where the possibilities of reconciliation are.
Take me back to Lonnie with an afro, your jeans, and you're just graduating, and you're wondering what to do in the world. What happens?
Well, at the end of graduate school, I was broke. I really was living on a teaching assistant salary. And a woman who was in grad school with me, who was much older than I was, she's probably 20 years older, basically said, you should talk to her husband who worked at the Smithsonian. And I remember thinking, literally, who works at the Smithsonian? Because it's where you take dates because it's free. So that was my notion of the Smithsonian. So I have this big afro, I'm in jeans, I'm in an Army officer's jacket that has Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club on one sleeve and Black Magic on the other. So I'm not getting a job. And so I go to meet the head of the Smithsonian, and we're just chatting. And I'm very cognizant of his time, so I keep looking at my watch, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour and a half. And then suddenly, I don't even remember what we talked about. And suddenly he said, you know, we might want to hire you. And I said, okay. And I thought I'd be in the American History Museum. And he said to me, we only have jobs at the Air and Space Museum. And I remember saying to him, I don't care about air and space. I don't know anything about it. And he gave me this lecture about how much money are you making now? And I said, $309 a month. And he said, come be a historian at Air and Space, and you make four or five times that. And I said, I'm a historian at Air and Space. And that really, that gave me a path that I never anticipated going down.
Today, you're the head of the Smithsonian, 7,000 people under you, and it's this vast institution of American life. What motivates you? What keeps you going?
Well, I think the major motivation is always remembering I'm a historian, always making sure that I'm doing history, that I'm engaging with history, that becomes sort of my North Star. And so as long as I can dip into the reservoir of being a historian, that keeps me moving. But the other thing that really keeps me motivated is that at a time when a nation is in trouble, right, when a time when there is partisanship, what you want are all the institutions trying to help to make it better. And when I look at the Smithsonian, I'm amazed at what a reservoir of possibility it is, whether it's through the amazing science we do that touches everything from, you know, life in the universe to climate change. When I look at the history that helps us understand all aspects of history, whether it's through a lens of gender or race or politics, I am just moved that it is a repository of understanding and hope. I get great satisfaction from the contemporary resonance of the Smithsonian to say that it is a place that, yes, you can go and just be in awe of. It's a place where you can revel in the past or go see pandas. But it's also a place that, beyond that, really provides understanding and clarity. And I think that when you need to have places to do that, the Smithsonian is one of the places that does that. And that's what keeps me moving.
In your talk in Trinity, you mentioned that for you, traveling is a way of learning, shifting perspective and coming to a different understanding of your own history and America's history, and particularly South Africa. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I thought it was really interesting.
In many ways, I was a traditionally trained American historian, which meant that you had a tiny little interest in a field outside of America, but mostly it's focused on America. And I realized that as I began to have really interesting international experiences that were deep, I found that I became different. I got away from American exceptionalism. I began to see that there were always the outsider in every community and recognized that I could learn from that. And for me, the most telling point was South Africa. So I went to South Africa in 1988, early 89, and I was invited at a major conference to talk about museums, monuments, and myths. And as I began to engage with people from South Africa, I was stunned at what I thought was the inherent violence. It's going to implode. And suddenly people were also talking about, however, our culture might keep us together, understanding our history. And it taught me that history is as much about today and tomorrow as it's about yesterday, which has been sort of one of the mantras of my entire career because of that time in South Africa.
Talk to me a little bit about African American history and the difference in your approach as a historian to composing the stories of African American history for the museum. It's often a history of remains, leftovers, annihilation, violations, etc.
Well, on the one hand, I'm very fortunate because I'm that second generation, or really the third generation, of people doing that work. So for 50 years, there were gifted scholars doing amazing work of rediscovering African American history, helping us remember people who shaped the nation. And so I benefited from that. So if this was 30 years ago, it would have been a very different endeavor. And in fact, that gave me a freedom. If I was building a museum 30 years ago, the key would simply to be saying African Americans are here too, that they played a role, that they were visible.
Secondary almost?
Exactly. And that what it allowed me to do is to say, that's part of it. That's a given. Let's make sure people understand the presence, the role, the impact of these people. But then what really this time that I was able to do, it gave me a freedom to say, but that's not enough. It's crucially important for this not to be seen as an ancillary story, not to be seen as something that wouldn't it be nice if we knew, but rather it is the central story of who America is. For me, it was then, how do I craft an institution that is that two-sided coin, that gives us that deep understanding of history? I want you to know names you had never heard or to think about a name like Frederick Douglass in a new way, but I also wanted everybody who came to the museum to say, this is my story too.
Lonnie G. Bunch of the Smithsonian there on a recent visit to Ireland, talking to Culture Files' Louise Williams. All Killer No Filler next. A time-honoured celebration in the East Cork village of Killer is this year reorientated for the moment by the collaborative arts practice Knock Studios, along with the village's art space Greenwood Arts. For this coming weekend, Celtic environmentalism will be reanimated in the Seed Pavilion, a temporary treehouse intended, if not for forest bathing, for something very similar with a Bealtaine spin. In advance of the festival this weekend, Culture Files' Rachel Andrews went to Killer for a walk in the woods with the pavilion's creators.
Can we see the woodland differently? Can it seed a new way of thinking or an old way of thinking, maybe? So very simply, we're building a 6-metre circular platform, and then around that 6-metre platform, we're building a timber structure, and the timber structure is actually made out of wooden pallets. My name is Philip Ryan. I'm a visual artist and co-founder of Knock Studio. Quite early in the project, we were trying to figure out what's a way of doing this that can pop up quickly, that the community can be directly involved in its making. And so we basically were trying to identify components that already exist in the world that we can use, and they can return to being those components. And pallets just became an obvious choice. And so we've just kind of designed a way of putting them together like Lego. And it's going to be clad in cardboard that's painted with a natural paint. We've basically integrated seed into the paint. And so when we demount that cladding, effectively it's almost a woodland in a cardboard sheet, you know, that it can go into the tree nursery that's just been established during the duration of this project. We're at a green space right beside the playground at the entrance to Glenbarra Wood. So this is effectively where the community ownership begins of the woodland. Traditionally for the festival, since it's moved back into Glenbarra Wood, this is where a lot of the activities would have happened. And the idea then is that as people come into the woodland for different events, they immediately have an identifiable landmark that they can congregate and meet.
My name is Jessica Boninfont. I am the artistic director at Greywood Arts in Killa. May Sunday is a festival that's gone on in Killa for almost 2 centuries now, but with us as the current caretakers, creativity and community are at the forefront. And we really wanted to do something that would mark place, but to involve community voices. We've been getting to know Phil in Knocked Studio, and I know that Phil's background is in architecture, but now fine art, so it seemed like a really good fit for this project. I mean, back to the 1100s, I think the De Capel Brooks were the big landlord in the area, and Ahado House and the Wood were their estate. In the 1830s, the landlord there made improvements to his estate, like new bridges and roads, and the story is that they opened the Wood on the first Sunday in May to the villagers. Normally, it was gated off, and so that was the only day every year that the villagers could go up into the Wood for music and dancing on the bridges. When Ireland became a republic, the Wood became part of the national forestry, and the festival shifted to the centre of the village. But you just couldn't do that on the main street because it's the N25, the main road from Cork to Waterford. So the traffic is just astronomical now, and you couldn't safely do anything in the centre of the village anymore. So we thought, why not bring it back into the woodland, which is now a large section of it is community owned. The community got together in the 1990s to buy a section of the wood with the aim of restoring the lake that had been there previously.
This is a model of your pop-up pavilion.
Roughly, it's going to be 3.6 metres high. And that's also because we're trying to allow people to go into the structures.
In the model, you have like people inside and outside. So I think random is something actually that you're quite interested in your practice. What could happen or might happen when people are also involved?
The interesting thing about the design of the pavilion that's arrived through this process of working with the community is the language that's been used here that came from those workshops isn't one we anticipated. And the interesting thing then about that language is that it actually is creating interior and exterior spaces even within the structure itself. So by entering into something, suddenly you are framing a view of something you're already in. And this idea of inside and outside happens a lot in nature, where it takes sometimes a window or a picture frame for us to focus our attention. And I think that's kind of what buildings do, is that you suddenly, the lack of something makes you appreciate something. Or in this instance, by stepping inside, you appreciate the outside. Or by it being outside, you might appreciate the inside. We're cladding the structure in cardboard. There's carbon in cardboard, you know, it is a paper product. You can use it in horticulture and gardening. And so we've been experimenting with, can we apply seed to cardboard? Can we embed it in the application of the paint we're using? So we're using a natural biodegradable paint. We're using, mixing seed into that. The seed we're using is all native species. So we have the common alder and downy birch. And then we have basically a woodland wildflower mix that's also, you know, certified native species. Trees and nature are a really good way of helping to mitigate against rainfall. And so one of the things through the project and working with other experts was that there's areas here where, like, for example, alder works really, really well in wet conditions, and it can actually help manage the water table. And that was the reason we're also identifying that as a species within the board, is that actually there's an immediate use for that. We wanted to plant and show how to plant tree species and native tree species. So we had Jeremy Turkington, who's the seed bank collector and coordinator for Home Tree Charity, come, and he had native species saplings. And we were like trying to identify where do we plant them in the woodland. And because there isn't really a proactive woodland management plan here, it just sort of occurred to us that maybe Greywood's Wall Garden would be an appropriate place to establish a woodland tree nursery. You know, the boards immediately are useful for establishing a sapling nursery and going through that idea of growing from seed and understanding that process and allowing the community to see that process. Personally, I've never grown anything from seed. I hadn't appreciated how extraordinary that actual process, that seed is both the life and death of a plant. We're calling the project the Seed Pavilion because not only is it a kind of a starting point for a longer process, but also it's seeding discourse about what the issues we've been talking about to the larger and wider community. The word pavilion comes from the old French word papillon, which means butterfly. That's because traditionally pavilions would have been tent-like structures, so the fabric would have reminded people of the wings of a butterfly. Our interpretation is slightly different because butterflies, we view them as transformative. You know, they go from caterpillar to a butterfly, and one form changes into another, they disappear. The power in pavilions is that they do disappear, that they're temporary structures that allow you to see the world differently.
Rachel Andrews there, reporting from down in the woods, and the Seed Pavilion will run till Monday, May 6th, celebrating in the treetops the heritage of Glenbower Wood. Now, if you've been listening to RTE Lyric FM at all this week, you'll have noticed that the station is celebrating 25 years on the air. For the occasion, Peter Curtin dived headfirst into the archive to fish out some of the voices and sounds that filled those years. So to finish this time, we're going to hear some of those memories. So here we have 25 years of Lyric in about 6 minutes.
Lyric FM, It's 12 o'clock on Saturday, the 1st of May. This is Ireland's new national music and arts channel, Lyric FM.
Good afternoon to you. Welcome once again. This is the sort of day which makes wearing a hat a rather interesting experience. I hope you're warm and cosy wherever you are.
During the performance, I was rushing up in my monk's cassock. I was rushing up the stairs to my dressing room only to meet a real monk. He stopped dead, his mouth open, clutching his rosary and making a silent sign of the cross because he thought he'd seen the devil.
When I was chatting to you beforehand, we were talking about the building, and you started to talk about the ghost.
Oh, yes.
And it took me a second or two to realise you were deadly serious.
Call it a ghost, poltergeist, what you will, but it is of the factotum of the theatre back in the 20s and early 30s, Johnny Hoy. He was the theatre, and he died in the room above us round about 1931. And ever after that, it is a live factor in the theatre. The last voluntary worker leaving here always has to shout up to the stalls, "Good night, Johnny."
OK, let's warm up, shall we? First of all, get the bodies sorted out. We should do a stretch.
Every Wednesday night, you'll find about 140 people in the RTE Radio Centre in Donnybrook, making a variety of strange sounds.
Very nice. Blah, 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 blah.
The rhythms themselves are based on the South Indian drum syllables. Tidikitada, tukatidikitada, tukatukatidikitada, tatatatatam, tatatatatatam. And the melodies then go on. Da 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 dum, ya da 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 dum.
I live alone, and sometimes I find myself singing one of the great songs like Cattle Moon or Slán Cuismhí or The Cúlan or Rosindo. And you hear the great airs coming back to you off the walls of your own house. And there are times like when a great song is almost like you can almost pour yourself into the song, and it holds your shape in the way that a bowl would hold water. It keeps your shape for that day.
Can I give you the email address, please, for World Requests? Now, it's all in lowercase. That is, no capitals in sight. worldrequests.lyricfm@rte.ie.
And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare along the flaggy shore in September or October when the wind and the light are working off each other, so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter, and inland among stones the surface of a slate grey lake is lit by the earth lightning of a flock of swans.
The first problem was to try and overcome how to have so many people deliver such a big text. And I thought probably that the choirs are wonderful, but there's a limit to what they can do in terms of projecting clarity. So I thought it was a good decision to have Paul, the poet, himself read the text, while the text is being read, are supporting the text, but they're not trying to deliver the whole thing. And I think that has helped the evolution of the piece a big way.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Paul Herriot on behalf of RTE, the National Concert Hall, Bordenamona, and of course RTE Lyric FM. It's my very great pleasure to welcome all of you to this, the opening concert of what is a very significant musical event, Composing the Island, celebrating a century of music in Ireland from 1916 until the present day.
Nowadays, everybody goes too fast.
Do you think so?
I think all the pianists play Chopin too fast and play especially the Prokofiev, and everything is as fast as they possibly can play it.
Why is this? Is it a quest for sensation?
I don't know. They don't always breathe with the music. They don't let the phrase finish. Before the phrase is finished, they start with the new phrase.
Giancarlo Menotti, we live in hope. Thank you for the music. Thank you for all the music.
Thank
you for sharing these few minutes of your 89th.
Thank you.
With us.
I worked with Renata Scotto and Bob Kettleson, and my favourite was Leila Genscher. She was the one real prima donna that I worked with. I don't know what age she was, but she was probably in her 70s. Just a wonderful character, she really was. She would come in with a train of people carrying all her things, and she would arrive with her hair back combed out 3 feet from her head and pitch black colour. But she looked at me and she used to call me La Boylan. La Boylan, she'd say. And she looked at me up and down and she asked me to stand up. So I stood up and she looks and she said, sei meno patata quest'anno, è vero? She said, you're less of a potato this year.
I find singing with my eyes closed, if my nose is touching the mic, it gives me that, I know exactly where I am.
That was 25 years of lyric there, created by Peter Curtin. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more time-lapse listening next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.